Hey there, Capital Region. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We're broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. My name is Alexis Goldsmith. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we start at the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, where clear-cutting for Crossgates Mall has caused conflict between developers, the town of Gilderland, and Save the Pine Bush. Then we speak with Rose Duhon, the Executive Director of the Community Healthcare Association of New York State. Later on, we hear the rest of HMM's Eileen Javier's interview with local musical favorite Taina Asili. After that, part two of our conversation with Sarah, also known as Miss Couple, on topics of intimacy and connection during COVID. And we wrap up with Dr. Nancy Campbell and a discussion of how overdose is portrayed in pop culture. But first, today's headlines. More than half of New York nursing homes with reported COVID-19 deaths were warned over the years that they didn't follow mandatory infection control standards, which are crucial to stopping the spread of viruses and other deadly diseases. At all New York nursing homes, at least 3,087 residents have died from the virus, or about 17% of all confirmed COVID-19 related deaths. Politico reports that in the lawsuit brought by former presidential candidate Andrew Yang against the cancellation of the New York Democratic primary, the state has argued that the cancellation did not harm candidates like Yang, who are no longer seeking the party's nomination. The state also argued that holding the contest, which would have taken place in June, would be dangerous because of the coronavirus pandemic. Yang has argued that the cancellation hinders the designation of delegates to leverage the National Party platform and would suppress votes for down-ballot primary candidates. A separate lawsuit against the primary cancellation has been filed by the New York Progressive Action Network. The Daily Gazette reports that Schenectady Mayor Gary McCarthy is proposing $5 million in cuts to the city's fire and police departments, with layoffs of as many as 67 staff. In response to budget shortfalls from the COVID-19 crisis, he is predicting a deficit in the budget between $9 and $11 million. Community leaders in Rensselaer County have formed a pandemic response committee to collaborate on COVID-19 related initiatives. The main focus is the impact on the business community and nonprofit groups. Politico reports that when Governor Cuomo announced that seven northeastern states would coordinate the reopening of their virus-shuttered economies, it was seen as a very public flexing of local government muscle, while Washington was trying to push responsibility onto individual states. However, the reality is far different, as each state is largely following their own plan for reopening. New York's upstate county leaders are raising questions about Governor Andrew Cuomo's reopening plan. Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan, as well as Albany County Executive Daniel McCoy did on Tuesday, has raised questions about whether counties have the resources or funding to be able to hire 30 contact tracers for every 100,000 residents. Ryan said they are being told the state may cut up to 50% of their local aid. Trump administration officials are telling staff members of the coronavirus task force that the White House plans to wind down the operation in the weeks to come, despite growing evidence that the crisis is raging on, the New York Times reports. Vice President Pence told reporters, quote, "We're having conversations about what the proper time is for the task force to complete its work and for the ongoing efforts to take place on an agency-by-agency level," end quote. Mr. Pence added that the task force could wrap up its work by early June. With Governor Cuomo extending his order closing school facilities through the remainder of the academic year, the Board of Regents on Monday shifted its focus to laying the groundwork for when schools do reopen. Betty Rosa, the state's education chancellor, said the regents were establishing a framework to enable participation in the reopening task force, starting with regional conversations before establishing the committee. The committee would then make recommendations to the governor's own committee on reopening the state and economy, and this was reported by the Schenectady Gazette. If you're just tuning in, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. My name is Alexis Goldsmith in the studio, but this show is produced by remote volunteers in our region. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, a tip, or you would like to write a letter to the editor, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary. In our first segment tonight, Crossgates Mall is attempting to clear-cut parts of the Pine Bush Preserve in Albany to put in a Costco, as well as additional development, including a gas station, townhouses, and 800 parking spaces. Grace Nichols of Save the Pine Bush talks about the recent clear-cutting, which allegedly had not yet passed environmental review.
We're talking with Grace Nichols, who is with Save the Pine Bush, and they and other neighborhood residents have recently raised concerns about the effort by Crossgates Mall to expand even further into the Pine Bush and to have done already some clear cutting of trees. But Grace, why don't you just start off with a little background about what is Save the Pine Bush and what is the particular immediate concerns that you have been addressing?
My name's Grace Nichols, and I'm an activist with Save the Pine Bush. And Save the Pine Bush, for 42 years, has defended habitat in the rare inland pine barrens of the Albany Pine Bush through litigation, for the most part. And currently, Crossgates Mall, which has already destroyed 167 acres of the Pine Bush, is asking to destroy another 43 acres of the Pine Bush, and particularly because one of these sites is very close and is a buffer for very important habitat for the federally endangered Carnaroo butterfly, and it's called Butterfly Hill. It was the last stand of the butterfly when it was nearly extirpated. So this is an additional acreage that provides buffer and protection for those butterflies. And so we particularly don't want to see that 19.6 acres developed. So we've said no to the entire 43-acre proposal. And it's pretty ugly. I mean, they want to have an additional gas station in sandy, permeable soil over an aquifer. They want a Costco. They want 3 5-story buildings plus townhouses as an apartment complex with 800 parking spaces right there in total, 700 parking places. So the entire project we have grave concerns around taking the habitat in the first place, impacting the species pretty massively, but also the climate effects of that kind of development. So that's the overall. It's currently under state environmental quality review.
Well, one of the things that interested me, or struck me, I should probably say, was that after they had started clear cutting the trees, in fact, I believe took down most of the trees, the town of Gilderland actually issued a stop work order and said that they had gone ahead without really having permission, that the town was still in its environmental quality seeker review process. How did that occur? How did the developer get the go-ahead to start clear-cutting trees when the town is saying, wait a moment, you don't have permission?
Well, this is pretty outrageous part, is that I got the call from Lynn Jackson from Save the Pine Bush that they were out there cutting, and I ran out there. And there was Crossgates security truck, there was a Gilderland police car, and there was a Carver Company's pickup truck with logging equipment, and then on the land there was a particular kind of automated logging machine. And so I parked and ran over there through the woods and sat on a log pretty close to the logging and said, you're here illegally. This is under seeker review. You can't log on a piece of land where, there's been no permission granted to develop this piece of land. you're violating state law. And after I had screamed this for quite a while, they stopped for an instant, and they said, get off the land, and they gestured to the police to come and arrest me. And I kept saying, I'm not here illegally, you're here illegal, this is community green space, and it's under secret review. So the police came over, they didn't actually want to have me breathe on them, so from 10 feet away, they said, you've got to go, or we'll arrest you. And what I noticed was logging was continuing, and nowhere in the U.S. is it actually okay to log with a person on the land, a non-logger on the land. That's why logging protest works, is they have to stop. But in this case, it did not stop, which was very dangerous for everyone. And so I walked off the land. The police never did arrest me. And it turned out that one of my fellow activists had actually gotten arrested earlier that day by similarly trying to inform them that they couldn't do this, and the police did arrest him, and that's Steve Wickham. He's pretty great. So what happened was I came home, and I called an NCON officer, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and they said they tried to get out there. They did actually arrive at 6:30 that evening, and it was too late to do anything. They already finished logging and packed up and gone home. And the next morning, after many calls to Supervisor Peter Barber, he said, oh, the town planner who had authorized and even put it on the website that was authorized had made a mistake, and actually it was not okay, and the zoning, one of the zoning board people issued a cease and desist order. I guess it was a clerk, and that came down. But like I said, most of the trees were gone. In fact, we just established they cut two pitch pine, one of the hallmark trees of the pitch pine scrub oak barrens, which is the pine bush. So, yeah, that was so illegal. It was authorized by Gilderland. It was enforced by the Gilderland police force. And we believe that this is a really good reason why Gilderland, town of Gilderland, should not be the lead agency making the decision under the State Environment Quality Review Act whether or not this land can be developed as an ecologically sound decision. And there has actually been a federal lawsuit filed to prevent them from being lead agency.
Well, I was suspicious. We only had time for one more question. So, you know, where do you go, or where does the public go from here at this point? And, you know, how can people get involved, or how can people, you know, raise their voices on this issue?
Thank you so much. Yes, we really do want your participation, and we really need your public comment to let Town of Gilderland know that you stand up for biodiversity. You don't want to see crossgates develop more in the pine bush. So what you can do is type in Save the Pine Bush into Facebook, probably the easiest way, and click like, and that you want to join, and you can drop us a note or a message, and we'll get right back to you. Alternatively, we do have a web page, www.savethepinebush.org, and we can definitely put you on our e-list. So those are ways you can get in touch, and we'd really appreciate if you would. This is an important fight.
You know, how has the state DEC responded to the fact that, you know, this was done in violation of the CEQA law? And, you know, have they come in and said, you know, maybe we should be taking lead jurisdiction here because clearly you guys have problems handling this process?
Interestingly, no. They have not made any statement like that. And we could speculate on why, but we don't know. Some of the neighbors of this development who are very upset about the development have done is they have worked with attorney James Bacon to file a federal lawsuit asking the federal government to federal courts to get involved and say that, no, once you violated state law to authorize the violation of state law, perhaps you are in conflict of interest and should not be the lead agency. So that's the argument that's being made. There's some other arguments. It turns out some of the land that they think is theirs to develop actually belongs to the town of Gilderland. It's never been ceded. So there's some other issues there as well.
So we have about 45 seconds left. A lot of the Save the Pine Bush, or some part of Save the Pine Bush, is still protected. If people want to go out there, how best they can do that?
Oh, we actually bring people out there if they're interested in seeing the land that's proposed for development. And yes, we can walk around the edge of it. There's places we can't go. There's places we can go. We've had many experts, you know, close to about 9 different PhDs have gone out there and issued reports on the land itself. Some of those reports have been, we're collating them in a gigantic report to the lead agency about what they are proposing to destroy.
Well, Grace Nichols, we want to thank you on behalf of Save the Pine Bush. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
The Times Union recently reported that environmental activists are suing over the clear cutting of the pine bush, and this fight will continue. Stay tuned to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine for continued coverage of environmental issues in the Capital Region. Up next, the importance of community health centers during public health crises and the challenges faced by these critical health centers during the global pandemic is discussed by Rose Duhon, the executive director of the Community Healthcare Association of New York State, as she joins HMM correspondent Corinne Carey.
Rose, thanks for joining me. Community health centers are the backbone of the healthcare system for vulnerable people across New York State. Can you tell us a little bit about Chicanes?
Thanks, Corinne, and thanks for having me. Community health centers provide primary care and are located in medically underserved areas. So they serve communities that otherwise would not have access to primary care in those places. That includes rural areas and urban areas all over New York State, from Long Island, every borough in New York City, to Plattsburgh, out to Chautauqua. We have over 800 sites where care is delivered, and those 800 sites are organized into about 65 different organizations. At those sites, they, in addition to primary care, they provide dental care and behavioral health services. Dental care is especially critical for many individuals who their primary insurance is Medicaid, or if they are uninsured. And another really fantastic feature about community health centers is that they serve everybody who comes to their door, regardless of their insurance coverage, regardless of their immigration status. Everybody gets served, and health centers have to provide care for those individuals that are uninsured. So we serve, health centers serve patients that are uninsured at a rate that's about triple the general New York State population. In New York State, we're really lucky to have very comprehensive Medicaid coverage. We have the full expansion of Medicaid benefits. So statewide, we have a very low uninsured rate. But at health centers, the uninsured rate is about 3 times that. It's about 16% of the population that's uninsured. Dental care is particularly difficult to find providers that will serve individuals on Medicaid or uninsured to provide dental care. And so health centers are really a critical source of dental care, and dental care is really critical to overall health and people's ability to do all the things they need to do to find employment, to go to education, as to maintain that they have good oral health.
So how do people access community health centers?
That's a good question. Community health centers, they are in every community, but how do you find them? Well, there is a directory on our website, the Community Healthcare Association website. You go to chcanys.org. There's a Find a Health Center button. Because they're located in the communities that they serve, they do a lot of outreach, a lot of health fairs, a lot of educational programs. So really, they are doing outreach to the people who need their services. And another interesting feature about community health centers is they're required to have a board of directors that is governed by their patients. So federal rules require that their board of directors be at least 51% patients of that health center that live in the community that is served by that health center.
Have community health centers throughout New York been providing COVID-19 related care? Have they been providing care that can't be delivered in facilities that are providing COVID-19 related care?
The COVID-19 pandemic has been very challenging for health centers, as it has for everybody else. The health centers are striving to keep their doors open and to serve the patients who really need the care. Health centers are located in communities that are being the hardest hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. So They want to make sure that they can continue to provide care for their patients. However, like everybody else, they are also trying to reduce exposure of, you know, among individuals, and especially among individuals who may be positive for COVID-19. Health centers have very quickly pivoted to providing a lot of care through telehealth, either an audiovisual or just telephone, to help protect patients and providers. A lot of health centers have implemented pretty strict measures to ensure that individuals coming into a health center aren't unknowingly infecting other people.
Community health centers are generally not flush with cash. I know they depend on state revenue. They depend on reimbursements. It seems like the extra precautions, in addition to a lower number of patients, could spell financial disaster. Is this something that community health centers are worried about?
Yes, absolutely. This is a huge challenge. Health centers have seen a huge reduction in patient visits, and that's been associated with a big reduction in patient revenue. 60% of health center patients are covered by Medicaid and CHIP. So Medicaid is really the primary source of funding for these health centers. And with the significant reduction of people coming into the health center for visits, there's the challenge of significant reductions in revenue. And as you mentioned, there are a whole new set of challenges in terms of ensuring adequate personal protective equipment for healthcare workers for just routine kinds of care. So that's been a huge burden. And as I said, people, health centers have really quickly had to transform the way that they're providing care. And so that's been a big challenge that health centers have stepped up to meet, but are really suffering from a loss of revenue. And that's a challenge. And we're worried about that looking forward. As I said, right now, a lot of patients are not coming into the health center. A lot of preventive services and routine care has been postponed. So we really expect that at some point there will be a lot of pent-up demand, and health centers are going to see a need for a lot of patients to come in the door. At the same time, right now, health centers have had to furlough a lot of staff, furlough, lay off, or reduce hours of staff. So we're really thinking ahead, how can health centers be ready to quickly ramp up to meet the demand that we know will be there? And at the same time, we're expecting that there'll be an increase in uninsured patients, given the state of the economy and the high rate of unemployment.
As the association that represents community health centers, what can you do to be ready for that influx?
So we've been doing a lot of advocacy with both the state and the federal government. At the state level, we've been talking about how the Medicaid program can support reimbursement for the virtual kinds of care that's being delivered now, telehealth and telephone. And then we're also talking about, even after the crisis, how reimbursement that's going to be critical for telehealth and telephone visits. One of the things that's happened during this crisis is that patients are able to receive care in their own home. And a lot of patients are finding that that's really a preferable way to receive that care. We're seeing a lot of behavioral health patients that are finding it much easier to connect with providers when they can do it from their own home. There's less stigma. There's less worrying about transportation, there's less waiting. So that's something that we think that's going to continue going into the future. And in some ways, there's no going back. So we're really advocating to ensure that the Medicaid payment stays in place for those visits. At the federal level, we're also doing a lot of advocacy. We did have some funding that was dedicated to health centers that was in the CARES Act that Congress passed. There was some funding specifically for health centers, and we were, of course, tremendously appreciative of that. But the amount of money that came to health centers funded about 3 weeks of losses, I would say, that health centers are experiencing given the reductions in volume. And so given that this crisis is going on for more than 3 weeks, there's still a significant gap in terms of the revenue losses. So we are also advocating at the federal level for continued relief.
If our listeners wanted to learn more and maybe participate in advocacy on behalf of their own community health centers, how can they most easily get involved?
I'll answer that two ways. I encourage people to visit our website, chcanys.org, and we have a lot of information there. We have a fact sheet about community health centers in general, and there's a link to our COVID-19 page. And on the COVID-19 page, we have some fact sheets about what health centers are experiencing during the pandemic. here in the Capital District. Whitney M. Young Community Health Center is a terrific health center that serves Albany and Troy. And if folks want to get in touch with them and see how they can, how you can help them out, I strongly encourage you to do so. And if you want information about them, I would encourage people to look for their website.
Rose, was it a mistake for state government, not just New York, but across the country, to discourage people from seeking care during the COVID-19 pandemic? One thing I worry about is that people did put off seeking care for treatable conditions that worsened during this pandemic. And I also worry about the loss of life. Is there a reason to look back now? Is it too soon?
That's a really difficult question. One thing that community health centers have really struggled with is to be in touch with their patients who have chronic conditions, and that's been really important in managing those chronic conditions, making sure that people who have diabetes, who have high blood pressure, that they're still doing all the things they need to do for self-care and doing that remotely. For community health centers, patients that are, you know, for individuals that are regular patients of a community health center, they're connected, and so health centers already know them and can reach out to them and provide that care. I think there's definitely a challenge for people who may not be connected to a usual source of care. Of course, I would also say that's why community health centers are so important, and we do a lot of outreach to really engage people in the community to make sure that they have a connection so that when there is a crisis, they're already connected and that care can be continued. And at the same time, it still remains a challenge for a lot of communities and a lot of communities that have been most severely impacted by the pandemic. You know, all the challenges that are coming out during this pandemic, they're not new. I mean, homelessness, racial disparities, those things all exist. Those of us who do work in this world, we all like live and breathe those things every day. And all of a sudden in a pandemic, all of a sudden those things come to the forefront. Maybe they'll get some more attention now.
And we just heard Rose Duhon, the executive director of the Community Healthcare Association of New York State. She was talking about the challenges faced by community healthcare centers during the coronavirus pandemic with HMM's Corinne Carey. If you're just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA 107.3 FM Albany. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. You can also get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. In our third segment tonight, continuing her work in social justice, art, and songwriting workshops on social justice, we hear from Capital Region musical favorite Taina Asili talking with HMM correspondent Eileen Javier.
So my grandmother is from Aguadilla, which is a town, for those who don't know, in like the northwest of Puerto Rico. And when I went to Puerto Rico, I found out that my grandmother was alive during, she was 4 years old during the last big earthquake that happened in Puerto Rico that had a tsunami in Aguadilla that destroyed all of Isabela and Aguadilla and that whole area. I mean, it was massive. So both my grandmother and grandfather were alive during that time. That was the last major earthquake, you know, and I think about that my grandmother alone, right, survived an earthquake, a tsunami, pandemic, forced migration, colonization, poverty, discrimination, you know, horrible working, slave-like working conditions. In fact, she grew up on a plantation. She wasn't, at that time, obviously, she wasn't a slave, but she was descendant of them. And so, like, this was, like, the time periods, you know, her lifespan and what she lived through to get me into existence. That alone, just her story alone, is profound. And I come from, and we come from, a lineage of people who have survived so much attempted genocide and enslavement and all of these things, you know, to make it through to this very moment that we're in. And so we are inherently in our DNA, in the very blood that runs through our veins, we are resilience. embodied, manifested into existence. So I just carried that with me to remember that as I figure out, like, how are we going to survive this pandemic? Boy, look at what we've already survived. We have our ancestors at our back to help us through.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are a songwriter, and as a songwriter, there is a possible album as a result of the COVID-19.
That is a good question. One of the things that I'm doing is taking it day by day, moment by moment, just like we talked about at the top of this interview, because right now we really are being asked to, I think, by the universe to pause, to stop, to take a breath. And, in this pausing and in this stopping and in this taking of a breath, so much I'm learning and growing, and also grieving. Like my father-in-law, both my mother-in-law and father-in-law were hospitalized were sick with the virus. Excuse me. My father was hospitalized and he's doing better, but we've been in a state of just grieving and worrying and stress and support for those in our community. So I'm not going to push myself to be too productive, because I want to be present for the needs of my children, the needs of my spirit, the needs of my community. But with that said, I will say that the last time I spoke to my father-in-law, which was yesterday, and gracias a Dios that he can speak now, because he actually couldn't even speak, he said to me, he's like, you need to write a song to help heal our world. And I don't think he's ever asked me to write a song or even like acknowledged that part of me. Like, we've never had a talk about it. But he was like, you need to write a song to heal the world. And so the fact that like he's alive now and has requested this of me, I definitely need to do something. So of course something will be coming, but I'm going to just let the day by day, moment to moment, unfold and see where it takes me.
Okay. And on that note, COVID-19 is bringing challenges for artists like you. You rely on public events and with social distancing. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, it has been challenging. I lost all of my income and I don't know when that's going to end. It's definitely the income that, that feeds my two children, keeps us alive. And so we're definitely thinking about how we can pull through this moment. And we're not alone, all different types of people, workers are struggling. But, one of the things that I did was on my birthday, I had a birthday concert and I invited people to donate to my Patreon page or to purchase music from my Bandcamp account. And, with that, it helps me to continue to do my art and continue to survive through this time, because a lot of us, I filed for unemployment a while ago and I don't know when we're going to see it, if we're going to see it. And in the middle of that, I've been working with 1 Billion Rising and One Fair Wage to demand, that we get stimulus checks regularly until this ends, and of course, I've been working on fighting for artists and other workers like myself who, don't receive a paycheck like that, to be able to be included in the unemployment, which supposedly has happened, but we'll see what happens actually. So I would say support artists, if you can, if you do have the ability to do so, and can make that contribution. If you don't need that stimulus check, not just artists, but anyone, any workers, any organization who's supporting workers who are in need, us artists are workers too, and many of us are working. We're continuing to offer our music and our creative arts for free online, to help us all through these times. So definitely supporting the artists and other workers that are the most vulnerable right now, and just doing our own redistribution of wealth, because we obviously can't rely on this government to do what's right.
Oh, I get you. So so where can people find you? I mean, if for your art and for events.
So for my, I'm on all the social media platforms, Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And I also have a Bandcamp page. And so it's tainaseely.bandcamp.com. And from there, you can purchase my music. I have a Patreon page where you can subscribe to donate even like $5 or $10 a month. And that helps to sustain my work over long term. And with that, you get like special perks, special things come with that subscription. And of course, I will be at some point, I'm not making promises of how often, but I will be doing online performances. But in addition to that, I've been, my main work, in addition to performing, is offering social justice arts workshops. And you can still hire me to do online workshops for your high school or college. If you're looking for interesting content, I've been doing some classroom speaking on Zoom and it's been excellent. So definitely you can check out my website for more information about that as well.
Okay. Okay. So that is in your website.
Yes. TainaSeely.com.
Okay. Okay. Well, I am looking forward for that song that your father-in-law asked you. And I know I'm going to be a beautiful song of healing from you. And I have to tell you before we leave, congratulations, because Resiliencia made one of the 40 best protest albums of 2019.
Oh, I didn't know this. Thank yes. you.
It's on the list of the 40 best protest albums of 2019. Wow. So your hard work is paying off. Oh. Continue your work. And I'm looking forward to that song. And thank you for talking with us today, Taina.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Much love to you and to all that you love. May you be healthy and safe and find moments of joy.
We just heard part two of musician Taina Seely. She had a conversation with HMM's correspondent Eileen Javier about her songwriting workshops on social justice and her album Resiliencia. Up next, survival skills for intimacy and connection during the pandemic is discussed with local intimacy and relationship coach Sarah, who is also known as Miss Couple, and HMM correspondent Christoph Di Maria. Her book, The Ultimate Guide to Bondage, is available for research and exploration.
I decided to download TikTok amidst all of this because if you're familiar with TikTok, then you know about the Flip the Switch challenge, which is people trading clothes, basically. And it's always done in the bathroom. So it's two people standing in their bathroom, there's music playing, and then they turn off the light and turn it back on. And when the light comes back on, they've switched clothing. One of my favorite ones was somebody and their grandmother doing it. And so, like, you're seeing into all of these people's bathrooms, though, for the first time, you know? And it's just, that's just fascinating to me. In the past, even with the virtual era, people have been pretty careful about, like, what they show in their home. They keep those cards very close to their chest, because our home, like I said before, is our safe space.
Do you have any tips, tricks, skills, techniques, anecdotes, anything poetic, something that you want to share with our listeners about ways in which they can nourish themselves during this time of isolation and uncertainty?
I will address all of that and then we'll end with something poetic. How about that? I think in general, it's just really important for people to realize that, you know, right now, this is an incredibly triggering time for all of us. You can be triggered by a variety of different things, whether it be medical trauma, worrying about our bodies, like worrying about gaining weight or body shame, body dysmorphia, different things in our relationships, like feeling suffocated or abandoned or feeling lonely and isolated, missing our families, maybe feeling devalued by our families. Maybe our families are driving us a little crazy. And I think it's really important in this time to just be patient with each other. We've seen a huge, huge, huge uptick in the number of divorces that or like requests for divorces during this time. And it's really because we're all in relationships are being put under a microscope. People don't really understand what their triggers are or what their bodies feel like when they're triggered. And I think it's really important to build awareness around those things. Understand that we all have different survival skills. And sometimes our survival skill can be directly in conflict with a survival skill of a lover or a family member. And so it's really important to think about those skills and how to set and create boundaries wherein everyone can take care of themselves without interfering or triggering each other. Also learning some of those survival skills don't really serve us very well. So, you know, how we regulate our nervous system, whether it be by exercise or by things that are more destructive like alcohol or drugs, there are other skills or other things that you can learn to help regulate your nervous system, like breath work, connection. And I think it's important to try to learn new coping skills that are more supportive of your general well-being. No matter what you're doing right now to survive, you are being incredibly resilient. Whatever your survival skill is valid. Hopefully it doesn't cause too much harm to yourself, right? We approach it from a harm reduction standpoint. I know everyone's doing their best. And I think that's also something that's really important to acknowledge. As far as maintaining sanity and general positive atmosphere for folks who are stuck at home with other folks, I think there's like an interesting contrast going on here, right? Everybody needs balance in their lives. So for the people who are stuck at home with other people, the grass is always greener on the other side, right? You know, they might want to be alone because you're constantly, you don't have space from these people like you normally would in a regular relationship, whether the kids are going to school or you're going to work, you're away from your family members for at least some part of the day and can have some alone time. On the other side, people who are alone are feeling incredibly isolated and are really reaching out and needing that human connection. I think it's important to just really focus on how to appreciate the situation that you're in and make the most of it. Being able to carve out space for yourself, whether it be taking a walk outside, going in a different room, sitting in your car, or going for a drive, you know, those things I think are really important and helpful. And it might feel, some people might have attachment anxiety where they feel safe with their family, so they don't necessarily want to leave or take time for themselves. But I think it's a matter of taking your medicine and doing something that in the long run will be healthier for you and your family and be more sustainable than constantly trying to coexist in a small space. And for people who are isolated, obviously, virtual conversations don't really come close to the physical connections that we have with other people. I highly recommend people who are alone, if they can, they use weighted blankets or covering themselves with like a bunch of blankets or pillows, really like get the feeling of being touched or held and release some oxytocin and other bonding chemicals into the body. I think that's really important. For people, maybe even just giving yourself a hug, a massage, the sensation of touch, really paying attention to your body, I think is incredibly important. Doing deep breathing exercises or tapping, all of those things are really helpful for releasing stress hormones and also just feeling a sense of connection. I think those would be my overall recommendations. You know, people are starting to realize that this is becoming a mental health crisis. Myself, like so many other Americans, really didn't understand my own mental health for a long time until I started studying it, sought out help, and really learned how to address different things that were mentally difficult for me. That is a really important skill. It's something that, especially under pressure, I think we are all starting to learn, like I said before, what our triggers are, what are using this time, you know, as learning experience. It has been a great teacher, myself and about others, and how we cope with feeling disconnected from ourselves and others. The days that are met with onlyness aid and abet this loneliness. Onlyness is this concept that you and everyone else kind of stand in a very unique spot in the world based off of your history and your experiences and your visions and your hopes. And you offer a very distinct perspective to the world. And getting in touch with your onlyness during this time, like what makes, not only what is difficult for you and what your traumas and triggers are, but also what makes you thrive, what makes you feel joyous, focusing on those things and following things that I say, like when something sparkles for you, following the things that sparkle for you is going to, I think, at least for me, it has really helped to carry me through this experience.
Given that you've provided now our listeners with a number of resources, tools, and ideas about how to both cope and thrive in this time, what aspirations or predictions do you have for the way that society in general or the community that you are a part of may change on the other side of what we're experiencing in New York, which is a statewide shutdown?
Something that I have really been heartened to see is all of the mutual aid and the support that has been, communities have been building for each other. I've been really impressed by that and the resilience of a variety of different communities and how people are really feeling good about helping to take care of each other. I feel like we were getting to a point in society where we were all so individualized, and social distancing can enhance that individualization. But I think in a lot of ways, the difficulty and adversity of this challenge has really brought people together. And so I just hope that people continue to work together moving forward, because that's been something really beautiful to see. I do want to say that I know that during this time, some people have been at home, literally stuck at home with folks who are unhealthy for them, who are abusive or causing domestic violence. And my heart really goes out to those people. If you find yourself in a situation like that, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE, which is 7233. And you can find them on thehotline.org. My heart goes out to you. I think you are all incredibly strong warriors. I just hope that you stay safe during this time. For everyone else, everyone in general, you can find me online at Miss Couple Official on Instagram. You can follow me there for all sorts of information about how to contact me, what services I offer. You can see what I've been up to during quarantine.
And we just heard local intimacy and relationship coach Sarah, also known as Miss Couple, discussing survival skills for intimacy and connection during the pandemic with HMM's Christoph D. Maria. And we'll close out the show tonight with the portrayal of overdose in popular culture by Dr. Nancy Campbell. She is the author of the new book, OD, Naloxone and the Politics of Overdose, on MIT Press. She'll be participating in the online harm reduction workshop sponsored by the Sanctuary for Independent Media. That's taking place tonight, Tuesday, May 5th.
My name is Steve Pierce. I'm here in the studios at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy with Nancy Campbell. She has a new book out called OD. Welcome, Nancy. What can you tell us about OD?
I became really fascinated with the way in which overdose was portrayed in popular culture, because I think that that really tells us a lot about how people are really thinking about others. And so one of my favorite such moments was what I would call the bringing out the dead moment. So you might remember that there are Pulp Fiction, for instance, contains a scene in which there is what seems to be like an overdose rescue or reversal, but it was highly stylized and it was not naloxone that was used, but it was adrenaline. And but what's interesting about that, those movies, Pulp Fiction, Bringing Out the Dead, is that they were used by harm reduction activists to kind of kindle their imagination for what might happen with naloxone. And so those movies stand almost as iconic moments when activists are beginning to realize, hey, wait a second, we could actually do this in real life, right? We could take a movie like Bringing Out the Dead and we could begin to think about the way in which overdose haunts us all. And in Bringing Out the Dead, there's an EMT paramedic character played by Nicolas Cage who actually goes with his partner into a nightclub and Narcans someone. And that moment, right, is a moment when Narcan, which was the trade name for naloxone at the time, and is today just a trade name for the intranasal naloxone product by Adapt Pharma. And so Narcan became a word. It became a verb, right? People understood that you could get Narcaned. And that takes a long time to permeate out beyond this sort of little cultural enclave where people know something about overdose and know that it's possible to survive overdose and know that overdose isn't abrupt, that you do have time, in other words, to save someone's life and time to intervene in what used to seem like an inevitable death. And I think that's the real moment that I'm going for. For a long, long time in popular culture, overdose was represented as an inevitable death. If you were using drugs, it was almost represented as a deserved death. You were unworthy, you were immoral, you were doing something that the society clearly viewed as wrong and unhealthy, and so you were consigned in a way to death. And I think the moment when that begins to really change, and it's always interesting when there are celebrity overdoses, right? They are often represented as moments when maybe we can get some of this education out there. Maybe harm reduction activists have kind of used the death of, say, Philip Seymour Hoffman as a moment to try to reverse some of the stigma surrounding overdose and to begin to educate people for instance, the problems of polydrug abuse, right? Which means that you're using opioids, but you're also drinking alcohol and maybe you're on a benzodiazepine. Well, those are three CNS depressants, and that could easily kill you. And so just educating people to that, I think, has been a major kind of triumph, because that the movement became much more evidence-based. It became much more, one of the reasons that I, in science and technology studies, tried to study it was because I was interested in the way in which people understood the science of pharmacology and the way in which evidence was produced by often this social movement to show that its interventions were effective. And I think that is a kind of research-oriented, evidence-based social movement, that's what really grew out of the HIV/AIDS movement, was the realization that, yes, we do need to and are able to think about a kind of people's science. In other words, what kind of science can people actually use to navigate their everyday lives?
My own experience with these subjects is, as I said, you know, as a kid in the 70s and 80s, there were basically two popular views of addiction, I think, drug use. One would be that drug users die of overdose. That's what happens to them, and that's the outcome of the choices they made. Or maybe for some people, they would say that society did it. The conditions that people lived in drove them to addiction, and so they were killed by those conditions as much as by the overdose. But how do you get to the point where there's a class action suit against the manufacturers of the drugs? That feeling of sympathy for the people who died or who suffered, and an understanding that the forces at play were much greater than individual choices.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. Over the 7 years that it took me to write this book, I have studied opioid, the history of opioid research, addiction research, of addiction treatment, of gender and addiction. This is my fifth book on the subject, and I have to say, it's like a whole new world. It is really remarkable how people came together and began to realize the harm that opioids could do. And I have a lot of respect, to tell you the truth, for opioids. They are dangerous, toxic substances, but they can, of course, they are very effective, and they can be exactly what someone needs in some times and places. And part of the question that I think this really puts before all of us is, how is it that in our society we have so many people living in so much pain, and we have so many people in what I would call existential pain, that we have a change in longevity of the entire population affected because of what are called deaths of despair, right? And these are not just opioid overdoses, but they are also suicide. They are also deaths that are connected to the consequences of the kind of world we live in. And so I became very fascinated with the notion that we all need to think about harm reduction. We need to think about the mitigation of the harms of runaway rampant capitalism in our lives. We need to think about the harms of the pharmaceutical industry, which of course has also provided a lot of these substances that we use to mitigate those harms. The pharmaceutical industry provides naloxone. Naloxone currently has to be made from an opium poppy base, just as does morphine, just as does oxycodone or hydrocodone or any of those, everything but synthetic like fentanyl. And so we have a world in which we have produced so much capacity to produce pain that we've had to create an industry that to alleviate it. And of course, physicians are caught between this industry and between the clients or customers of both the licit and illicit drug traffickers. And so we have both legal and illegal. We have such access, such availability to opioids today, facilitated by both legal and illegal trade and traffic. So we have a real conundrum to deal with. And naloxone is just a Band-Aid in that, right? So one of the conclusions that I came to was that we need to create a harm reduction infrastructure, and we need to really think about the place of harm reduction in all of our lives. And we need to consider what aspects of our lives we can reduce the harm. In my world, I carry naloxone, and I would hope that everyone who can would come to understand naloxone and what it can be used for. But at the same time, I don't kid myself that this is all we need. I think we need a lot more than naloxone.
Nancy Campbell, Chair of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, and author of the new book, OD.
And that was Dr. Nancy Campbell. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. My name is Alexis Goldsmith. This show is produced by local volunteers working remotely to bring you the local news, an amazing group of people. And remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. The H. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is on every weeknight at 6 p.m. live, and it replays every weekday morning at 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. You can also tune into our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, would like to write a letter to the editor, or a story idea, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.